Hello and welcome to this retrospective episode of the Nothing Ventured podcast. So I really started this podcast so that I could learn from others, and I hope you listen along because you learn as well. And I've been really fortunate to interview some of the most incredible VCs, angels, and operators who are making a dent in the tech and venture ecosystem. So in today's episode, I want to really salute those operators and take a look back at some of the incredible people that we've had on in season four who have shared their knowledge and expertise, all with a view to helping you and others like you build better. So we're going to hear from Arthan Sarella Hashemi, deep tech investor at Karma Ventures and an ex-VP of finance in a previous life. Samir Singh, venture partner at Speed Invest and an investor and mentor in all things network effects at Breadcrumb VC. Amadeep Parma, co-founder of the Bay HQ and host of the Entrepreneur's Handbook. Zoltan Vardy, founder of the Launch Code. Maya Mufarek, founder at Marketing Cube, and Matt Johns, co-founder at Founders Enlightening, all of whom had incredible stories and lessons that they were able to share with me, and I hope that you get a kick out of listening to them as well. Let's get into it.
Most of us, and it's not just corporate, it's like the entire business world is basically punishing you on mistakes.
Yeah. So school essentially is the first.
So you're trained not to make mistakes versus to look at mistakes as learning opportunities. And you'll be surprised, but I, as a board member, interviewed people, as like operator, interviewed people in startups. People jump into a job in startups and are afraid to make mistakes. And you can see that a lot, because a lot of people probably in interviews ask, okay, tell me about your failure. What time you failed? And 90% of the people, when I ask that question, give me a general example where the team failed or the company failed. And I stopped them. I was like, no, no, I wasn't asking about general. Like, when you feel you personally failed, and you can literally see in that, like, they flutter. Like, how do I address that? Like,
I'm going to come off badly if I if I actually say I failed.
So a lot of that becomes, okay, like, if you're able to talk about failure and actually analyze that, that's a good signal for me as a person that hires. And that's in every job, like as a VC and as a startup, that you are able to do that, and I don't need to spend time teaching you how to do that. And it's once you're in, and even when you manage people, even when they are accustomed, quote unquote, accustomed to do it, it's really interesting to see, because a lot of what you do as a manager, if you, especially like most of my roles later on in life, were managing people, is especially in startup, is letting them feel comfortable that you got their back, that they will fail. And I had this discussion with every direct person I manage, and literally in one way or another said the following, like, we need to move fast. We accept that moving fast makes, I need you to ask for forgiveness, not permission, which means you will make mistakes.
You're going to have to risk.
But you will make mistakes. And if you don't do mistakes, we're not moving fast enough.
Yep.
That means I got your back. It's never your mistake. I'm the boss. Accountability is with me. And you literally see people shift by like feeling more relaxed to do that. And of course, it takes time to start going into it. But like that aspect of having that discussion, which is like, I own this, but you need to execute. And I get that. I want you to run. Make mistakes. And every time I tell them, like, you're not making enough mistakes, people are like, what do you mean? I want you to make more. That means we're not learning fast enough. We're like moving fast enough. And that mind shift is a lot easier for people that are self-reflective and are able to do that.
Moving on from that a little bit, look, we talked in the primer about, you know, or you mentioned certainly in the primer, you know, like Nokia, Skype, right? And I think a lot of us forget that there's been some incredible tech that's come out of the Nordics. You know, we were talking about the Oura Ring, as I mentioned, Nokia, Skype, but you've had Spotify, you've had various others. But I would hazard a guess that most of our audience will have limited experience of the venture ecosystem as a whole in the Nordics and the Balkans.
Yeah.
How would you describe it? And what does it offer that other regions might not? And I guess, are there areas where it can improve or grow on top of that? Or, you know, how do you look at the whole ecosystem out there?
So do you want me to focus more on the VC side of things, or more like the venture ecosystem or the startup ecosystem, or both?
I guess a bit of both, yeah.
Okay, so I guess to characterize it, it's very much like each country typically has its own set of like early stage VCs who only operate in that country.
Mm-hmm.
So people like Lifeline Ventures in Finland, or you'll have, say, like Trind, who like a lot of them operate within the Baltics and Nordics across borders, but they operate within just that ecosystem, which coming from London, a lot of the early stage companies invest across Europe,
even
like pre-seed or seed. They don't limit themselves by geography, they do more by industry. And so it is much more geographically based VCs than industry specific. And then as you, there are the kind of a few who invest across Europe, or like ourselves, at the kind of bridging to growth stage. So pre-seed and seed, sort of geographically locked. And then there are some who kind of bridge the gap to Europe. And then at Series B onwards, you get your kind of large funds who come in and just kind of pick the best of the bunch, so to speak, as I think probably they like to think. And then that's kind of how the VC side of it works. And you'll see that a lot of local events where, if it's a slightly more local event, it's the same people at a lot of the events. And I'm already beginning to be like, oh, okay, you know, it's people from, you know, various different funds in the Nordics. And that's typically Nordics and Baltics. That's how it works.
What is this? What is the summary?
The importance of them comes down to the fact that it gives you two really big advantages. Mm-hmm. One is it makes your business, I mean, massively scalable in the best case scenario, which means users are going to get more and more valuable over time. So unit economics, when you start making money, should get better and better over time. Of course, there's exceptions to this. If you have weak network effects, it might not sort of pan out. The second benefit is defensibility. Strong network effects are probably the strongest form of defensibility that you can have. And again, there's a spectrum here. You can have weak network effects as well. But if you get both of those right, they can lead to super outsized outcomes.
Effectively, you're crowding out other players from the space because you are
essentially nobody can compete with you because you have the most valuable product. So Airbnb being like the classic winner take all model. Like, there's nobody else doing what Airbnb does because it's fundamentally not possible to compete with them. And based on this, the VC firm NFX just ran some numbers, and they figured out that since 95, of all the companies that have reached $1 billion in value, 35% of them had network effects, which seems like a lot, right? But those companies account for 70% of the total value.
Amazing.
So just in terms of the amount of value creation that has happened over the last 30 years, network effects have been at the center of them. And fundamentally, I still don't think most people understand a lot about them outside of this basic construct of what the network effect is. And they're often confused with virality. They're confused with, you know, straightforward inventory carrying businesses. There's lots and lots of confusion as to what they are. But when you drill down into what a network effect is, when it's strong and provided the execution was right, it's almost sort of a bulletproof way to build a valuable company.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. In fact, I mean, one of the questions I have is, okay, you know, you just mentioned that a lot of people get confused with virality, et cetera, et cetera. So what are the challenges when building a business reliant on network effects? And what are founders and indeed investors get wrong about network effects? Like, how do they, you know, how do they differentiate between a business that has maybe strong virality but not network effects, or vice versa?
Well, the easy answer is the vast majority of founders and investors don't. I cannot tell you the number of pitches I've received both from founders and from other investors going, hey, this is a network effects company, and essentially it's not. The definition of virality is that users spread the word about the product in process of using it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in some vague way, it sort of looks like a network effect. It's sort of, people associate network effect with growth.
Yeah.
And so they essentially go, this company has product-led growth, but therefore it has network effect, which is not true.
Mm.
And there's other companies that sort of look like marketplaces, but they're carrying their own inventory, like gorillas, right? Mm. Lots of people said, oh, this is the next great marketplace. No, sorry, it's not a marketplace. There's no seller there. They're the seller.
Yeah.
And so that's essentially the same as Tesco. It's just that they have an app.
Yeah.
They only have an app to sell stuff.
You heard it here first. Gorillas is just like Tesco. A lot of thought in my head has been about, you know, when does one take on sponsorship and things like that. And I don't want to necessarily go into the details of that, but the minute you start monetizing what you're doing in some way, shape or form, I think people then also kind of their radar pricks up and they're like, okay, well, you're doing this because it is providing some sort of benefit to you. And of course there is a benefit to both of us in appearing on our respective podcasts, but the benefit is actually much broader, much more subtle than an exchange of money, a transactional exchange. And I think actually, you know, when we were talking about content earlier, one of the things that I think it's probably most important when you're starting to do any sort of content is to not actually worry about how am I going to monetize it? Where's the money going to come from? Like, what, you know, one of the best podcasters out there, Dan Murray Setter, I think, you know, I can't remember the exact numbers, but, you know, he just sunk money into his podcast, you know, Secret Leaders, for a long time. And I think now it's actually, you know, garnering him some money. But that was never the sort of objective. It was about creating amazing content that people want to listen to. And again, it came back to, like, when you said there about, you know, telling their stories and how they failed and how they overcame those, it comes back to that whole concept of narrative and what people engage with, which is humanity, right? It's like, we want to understand about people, what drives them and what motivates them, not just the kind of, you know, tick list of this is what I've actually achieved. But you know, going a bit further into this whole concept of, you know, creating content and driving that content. So you were one of the fastest growing writers on Medium via the Entrepreneur's Handbook, I think. So talk me through that. Like, was it something that was, you know, strategic? Like you said you just started writing. At some point, did you decide, okay, actually, I'm going to do this in a specific way to build that audience, etc.? Or were you just like in the right time at the right, you know, at the right time in the right place? Talk me through how you built to that 50K and thereafter, like what happened.
Sure. So on the content side as well, what I think is really important people to acknowledge as well is there's so many people online right now telling about how to make money from content, and that's monetizing for YouTube or for Medium, which is actually a really bad idea. I genuinely advise most people. What it's good for, say from this podcast, is people now know about your business. That's the better play. And that's what business should be thinking about. They shouldn't be thinking, how can I break even by making money for YouTube? Don't think of it as a revenue source directly. Think about how the brand awareness and what that can lead to. And that's what people should be thinking about. Medium, for example, is don't stake your life on making money from the Medium Partner Program. Like, I was making that amount of money, but I would never promise anybody else they can make that amount of money too. And that's what a lot of people do, which is quite scammy in my eyes.
For the audience's audience's information, I make 27 pence a quarter for the Medium Partnership Program. Yeah.
Yeah. So
100%.
Before I was quitting my job, I was making close to 10K per month from it, right?
Amazing.
Which put me in the top 0.001% or whatever. But for me to then tell you, oh, I can teach you how to do that, that's just bull, right? Because one, there's luck involved, there's my personality involved, it's all these different factors. I can never promise that. And in terms of my own journey, it started off as just completely for fun.
How to actually kind of build out that sales process and so on. So look, dealing with enterprise customers is hard enough, right? We all know kind of the lead times that it can take, the amount of pressure that they put on. But for startups who have limited track records and ultimately limited resources as well, it's even harder. So you talk about cracking the corporate fortress, right? What are the key activities that startups and founders should use to breach those corporate defenses, if I can put it that way?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it starts, first of all, with understanding. And what I mean by that is that when you're a startup, your mindset is very much about speed, right? Mm-hmm. It's about moving things forward quickly. It's about testing, breaking things, getting to yes quickly. When you're speaking to corporations, you are talking to people who have the polar opposite approach to business. The single most overwhelming principle of corporate decision-making is certainty, right? That is what is driving everything. What does that mean in practice? Scenario planning, you know, projects are budgeted. Decision-making is slow. It's built on consensus. People, you know, focus on internal politics. You know, their belief is that speed kills, right? And I say this because I run 1,000-person organizations. I've worked in that matrix sort of organization where everybody's responsible for everything, but nobody makes a decision on anything. So I can speak from personal experience that that there is just generally a sense that you know, making a decision too quickly is the bad thing. So the reason I emphasize this is because it's important that this clash of mindsets is understood and accepted, because it's sort of like gravity, right? You can be really angry that, you know, the pen drops out of your hand, but that's just the way that life works, right? So that's, you just live with it. So that's the first thing. The second thing, and that's to manage expectations. The second thing is, I think you have to make sure that when you think about enterprise sales, you don't lump every company into the same basket. Not all corporations are created equal. There are certain characteristics of companies who are more likely to do business with early stage startups than others. Mm-hmm. What are some of those characteristics? First of all, I would look for what I would call companies that are deer rather than elephants. So elephants, of course, are the big lumbering animals, the market leaders, the ones who really don't have that much incentive to change because they're already in a strong position. The deer are the ones who are second tier, maybe even third tier within their category, who are much more limber, much more agile, are capable and are willing to try new things because they have something to win, right? So they have something to gain. So what I'd say is look for deer rather than elephants. Focus on private companies rather than publicly traded companies. Why is that important? Because publicly traded companies work to quarterly results. Mm. They're not prepared to take significant risk that is going to damage their public stock price. Look for companies that have a strong HQ or central decision-making authority, and make sure you speak to those and don't waste your time talking to subsidiaries who don't have the budget or the authority to say yes. And look for startup-friendly signs. You know, there's a lot of companies that have corporate accelerators. They have corporate venture capital arms. They have maybe a head of innovation or, you know, relevant leadership role. These are all really important signs that company is better for you than others. So if I had to kind of like create the perfect corporate customer, challenger position, privately held, headquarter decision maker, and startup friendly element. Those are what I would think to keep in mind as you target these type of customers.
The kind of core principle that I talk about is narrative over numbers, right? So everything comes back to, what is the story that you can tell? What is the narrative? What is it that will grab people? I think this is partly because I'm a linguist. I was someone who loved the English language growing up, loved sort of writing fiction, et cetera, et cetera. And the power of stories, and I love Terry Pratchett talks about, you know, human beings as being the storytelling ape, right? The power of those narratives, that's what grips mm-hmm. people. That's what gets people engaged. Mm-hmm. It's what yep. brings them to your brand. It's what brings them yep. to your service. No one wants to buy, you know, a thing. You know, it's why Budweiser's got in a bunch of trouble recently for whatever their yeah. recent marketing campaign yeah. was. It's why Ben and Jerry's constantly are kind yeah. of like in the news as being overly woke or whatever. Mm-hmm. But they've realized that their narrative is just that, right? Mm-hmm. That they want to present themselves as a company that cares about whatever that topic is, because it might be core to their identity, but it's clearly core to their customer's identity. Or maybe that works the other way around. Their customers are drawn to them precisely because they've set themselves out to have that core identity. So how would you recommend to companies that are struggling to understand their own identity and create that narrative? How can they start? Is it a question of sitting down with someone like you and just having a conversation to and fro? You know, can you chuck something into ChatGPT and say, you know, ask me 20 questions and then develop my mission? Like, what's the best way of going yeah. about it?
I mean, there's two ways here. You know, some founders start, you know, if we take Ulife again as example, they start with a clear vision, mission, understanding of how they're trying to transform that industry, right? So that will guide a lot of your narrative. Obviously, it needs to resonate with your audience, and it needs to meet what your audience is trying to get out of it as well. Mm. Some others obviously will be like, you know, there's a problem to solve. It's a worthwhile problem to solve. You know, I don't have any bigger kind of, you know, raison d'être than trying to solve that problem. Then really starting with your audience, with what resonates with them, what are the struggles in their lives and things like that. You know, I mean, take something as dull as an accounting software that both you and me have to use and hate on a daily basis, despite great ones being out there. What do we want to do? We don't care for the accounting software. We just want to run a business and ideally do as little accounting as possible, right? So, you know, those kind of businesses are very functional businesses. There's no, apart from possible hate, sorry, accountants, like there's not that much emotion in accounting from like the day-to-day user.
But interestingly, like a lot of them, like QuickBooks, I think is a great example on LinkedIn, you'll see their ads and they're the most frustrating ads on the planet because they almost try and drive emotion and the emotion is actually like anger.
Yeah, you know, right, possibly. But surely what you and I want to feel actually is just like, I'm doing right by my business and things are automated enough that I can focus on my business, not my accounting.
Make it easy.
Right. And so that's where that's really starting with your customer, right? It's really understanding what's frustrating them, what are they actually trying to do with their lives, and how is this just a micro component of this, you know, greater why?
Yeah.
Right. So that's kind of the two ways. Usually the founders that start with a mission and a vision in mind, often are also the worst at articulating it, and they kind of need to be like interviewed and someone played back to them, because sometimes they don't even realize the power of that ambitions of their mission, and they're like, you know, I kind of talk about this, but you know, it's maybe a bit, you know, quirky, or it's maybe a bit, you know, woke, or you know, uninteresting to people or something, I don't know. Like, and you really need to listen to them, download that, and play it back to them.
Yeah, and often so many of these things are emergent, right? Rather than fixed.
They don't always have exactly the right language and things like that, but the essence is there.
Or are you interested in kind of, like, so you talk about, you know, digitizing existing businesses or business models, right? Like, would you look at businesses that are more or less lifestyle or might grow to 10 or 15 or $20 million, or are you looking for venture scalable?
So we're getting in typically at a sub 2 million valuation. Mm-hmm. So if those companies exit for 20, we're very happy.
You're happy.
The founder's very happy.
Yeah.
I think there's a big issue with certain VCs pushing founders to scale too hard, too fast, and not really being bothered whether it works out for the founder or not. So we are, we're not looking for unicorns, and we don't want moonshots to save the rest of the portfolio.
Yeah.
You know, we work extremely closely with these founders on a day-to-day basis. And we would much rather have exits that are sub 100 million, but have more of them than the other way around. Now, it's not to say that we certainly wouldn't argue if one came along.
Yeah.
But we're not relying on them. Our model doesn't rely on them.
Yeah. You're not looking for the outliers only.
We're not.
You want to build a base of like strong, profitable, valuable businesses.
And I think, you know, there's this misconception for founders that VC is the only way to go. And actually, you know, a lot of our portfolio companies have now raised VC money, you know, so it's not like we want to get them venture backable, but then we guide them to maybe, you know, work with a VC that's not looking for 100x return.
Yeah.
You know,
there are not many of those, but yeah.
But they do exist. They do exist.
Yeah.
The founder, if the founder sells for 20 million, they don't have to work again.
Yeah.
You know,
100%.
And what we found, and I don't have huge amounts of data for this, but this is, you know, fairly anecdotal, but I think it's hard, of course it is, but I think it's easier to get to a 20 million than it is to go and sell for £100 million plus. And it sounds obvious, but why not do it then?
Yeah, well, I wrote about this a little bit earlier today, I think, but the reality is I think we all get caught up in the, you know, in the veneer of success that, you know, is shown to us on LinkedIn and Twitter and TechCrunch and all these things. And I think a lot of founders, especially because a lot of younger founders tend to be slightly naive and slightly kind of, you know, believe themselves to be a bit immortal. They don't quite understand what the journey looks like when you take on venture capital, which is a really tough journey. Like Dan Bowyer from mangled his name a little bit, but from Superspeed just wrote about this again this weekend. You know, he was really candid. When you take venture money, like, there, you know, if there are five things in your life, choose three of them because you're not going to be able to do all five, sort of thing.
I just think there's this massive opportunity for people not to chase that.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree.
If you look at most of the exits in this country, then they're in the tens of millions.
Yeah, I mean, look, I obviously speaking to a lot of VCs, there is a lot of, I guess, angst about the fact that, you know, there aren't those massive unicorn style exits. And, you know, part of the reason for that is an inefficiency, as they would see it, in the kind of IPO and the larger market, right, in the private, in the public markets. some of which has now been unlocked with the, you know, pension, the ability reform. That, yeah, for, with the pension reform, with the ability for pension funds to invest. But yeah, look, I mean, I think there are, you know, there is this question here in the UK and Europe is like, why aren't there more unicorns and how do we grow that? But equally, and I think this is as valid and invaluable as anything else, because of the way venture works, where, you know, 90% of businesses are likely to fail within the first 5 years. If those 90% of businesses that failed instead were not chasing unicorn valuations, but were going for, like, you know, significant but you know but manageable growth and value, maybe we would see, you know, more employment, more value creation, and potentially, you know, more growth in the ecosystem.
It's very hard to replicate the ecosystem that, say, America has.
Yeah. We're 20 years behind, I think, is the other. But, even 30 or 40 years behind. Yeah.
Do we want to replicate it?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Yeah. might be a question you want to take up with Rishi and and Jeremy, I think, in that case. Just before we close off the primer, if there were three ventures that you're excited about, either inside or outside the portfolio you have, what would they be?
So I'm not accused of being biased on our, because we've got 36
sure.
now.
Sure.
So I'll talk about our two most recent investments. So there's a company called Cake Drop. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, a real show of how we maybe invest in things that are slightly quirky or slightly different to the typical VC. So it's a corporate gifting company.
Yep.
So they actually own a bakery. Nice. So they provide, you know, cakes and treats and stuff customized for corporates.
Yep.
So when we invested, they you know, we did all of it on spreadsheets, a WordPress website, and have done really well to get where they've got to. And now our job is to turn them into a tech-enabled company.
Yeah.
So not necessarily a pure tech company, but tech-enabled.
Yeah, make the processes replicable. Yeah.
And this is where the opportunity is with these types of companies. It's not just on the front end. It's not just what the customer sees, although, of course, that's important. It's behind the scenes. Mm. You know, how can you automate things so that they can hire their staff?